I'm going to have to ask you to be a little patient with me this morning. I'm fighting a bad case of flu, but we hope that it'll work out all right. This morning we are dealing with one of the basic realities of life. We are celebrating the most important event in the development of the Christian faith. We are accepting the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a spiritual reality and as a proof of an omnipotence beyond all mortal control and directive by which the individual can become closer in his understanding of God, life, love, and his own faith. Actually, as Abraham Lincoln pointed out, the Bible is not only a great inspirational book for most people, it is also the most important book for the government of nations. It is a great document of administrative policy in all parts of the world. Now, this may have been generally overlooked, and it has been ignored for centuries, but the truth of the matter remains that the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, the teachings at the Last Supper of Jesus, and the various sermons and talks that he gave along the roadway of Galilee, these are without question the most important foundations for an enduring society, individual or collective, personal or international. Today, over 2 billion persons are in one way or another celebrating this day, and probably 500 million more of other faiths but sympathetic to the ideas and message are joining in this ceremony. This ceremony of 2 billion dedicated persons arises from the life and teachings and labors of the man who said, "We are all brothers. Love one another." Now, the Christian faith has done just about everything it can do to promulgate or distribute the realization of it. But neither the faith nor its followers have been able to establish a culture based upon mutual respect, mutual kindness, mutual charity, and mutual love. A great teaching of cooperation is overshadowed by a vast world of competition. The good of the other person is now very secondary to the advancement of our own objectives. The human being is no longer his brother's friend. He is no longer supporting those around him in principles and integrities. He is placing profits above principles. And in so doing, and by this simple act, he has broken the law of God, Christ, and man. And as a result of that, we've had 5,000 years of misery due largely to the fact that the human being simply does not have the strength of character to keep the rules that keep the peace. Now, the only law behind this that we can really feel or understand is something within ourselves. For long times, we have been trying to find definitions for the word love. There are thousands of definitions, religious, sociological, theological, philosophical, and even scientific. We have been trying to find out what love is. But we will never find it by trying to get a definition out of a book or something of that kind. The only way that honest, simple, genuine love can be transmitted is by experience, by the absolute fact of itself. Van Dyck and the other wise man summed it up rather beautifully in the words, that who names it shall never find it, but who finds it will never need to name it. Love is an experience of consciousness, an experience in the soul of man. It is something that is a great releasing power against the tyranny of personal attitudes. It is placing something bigger than yourself in the foreground of your life. It is dedicating your acts to projects, to purposes, to convictions that are of common good to all mankind. Love, therefore, suffereth long and is kind. But today, the average individual is not interested in suffering long for anything. And he is not too careful with his kindness if it is contrary to his objectives of the moment. That we have come so far, suffered so long, endured so many wars, and never discovered kindness in the relationships of nations is unbelievable. And it is still more unbelievable that millions of good people, kindly, well-intentioned, well-purposed in life, still have their hates, their fears, their doubts, their prejudices, and all the negative attitudes and opinions which separate humanity. Therefore, it seems that this morning, when we celebrate the resurrection of the Prince of Peace, that there is something that we should all think about rather carefully, and that is to find out whether in our own lives we are able to actually practice a few of the simple admonitions which we have received from Christ. Are we able to be kind to each other? Are we able to forgive our enemies? Are we able to do good to those who despitefully use us? Are we willing to continue quietly in a meek way of life? Are we interested in the simple humilities of virtue? Do we want a happiness that arises from making others happy rather than sacrificing them to our happiness? Do we want a happy home? Are we willing to support it by character, by integrities? Are we willing to keep the rules by means of which we can keep the world in order? Now, the idea of love is not a new one, but on through the ages, it has passed through innumerable definitions, and it has been mixed up with a great many other emotions and attitudes. Love is not just a single thing. It is not something that is born full-blown from the unknown and the invisible. Love is the gradual maturing of a whole circle and cycle of attitudes. Love is the individual gradually growing up. True love is impossible to the immature. The individual who has no self-discipline, has no consecrations greater than his own interests, can never truly love anything. And if he tries to love something, he will end up only loving himself, which is the most dangerous of all pursuits. So to have a true understanding of love, the individual must grow. He must not only outgrow selfishness and self-will, but he must also go above and beyond what might be termed the pressures of society upon his life. He has to be an individual. He has to live his principles, whether others do or not. Nations must do the same. The individual cannot love until he has achieved a kind of psychic or emotional maturity. Love is a mature emotion. It is not the mysterious bubbling of adolescence. It is a deep, lasting, enduring dedication. Love is not merely staying with it till it hurts and then walking out on it. Love is not merely getting into various emotional situations for profit, for gain, for social standing. There can be no selfishness and no self-centeredness in true affection. Also, love cannot be bought, bartered, or sold. Love can never be tempted into existence by luxuries, by social advantages. It remains, as it has always been, basically the purest of all human emotions. And if it becomes adulterated or becomes defiled, it is one of the most terrible adversities with which we must struggle in our course of existence. An example of this point, I think, I probably have told you before, but maybe long ago. I knew a young man who grew up in a small family, and he had a sister. And when this sister was about 15 years old, she was stricken with polio. And from that time, she never walked again. This young man made himself, so to say, her constant attendant. He protected her in every way possible, sacrificed every sport and pleasure that would normally have been his because of his great admiration and devotion for his sister, whom he deeply loved. After about 15 years of this relationship, the sister died, and the young man was left to start out on an individual life of his own. What did he do? He married a very wonderful girl who had been paralyzed at birth and spent the rest of his life taking care of her. He wanted something to serve. He did not want people to serve him. He did not necessarily want to be loved, but he wanted to love with everything that he had. He wanted to dedicate his life to making somebody happy. And no education he could have secured elsewhere, no degree in science, philosophy, or religion, could have given him the wealth of life and the tremendous internal growth that the simple devotion to the need of others resulted in him possessing. And finally, the wife also passed on after about 30 years. And someone said to him, "John, I don't know how you did it. You had to get her up and down every day. You had to carry her. You had to come home from your work every noon and cook her lunch. She could do nothing. You had to watch her all night for 30 years. It must have been a terrible strain on you." Well, he said, "It's no strain at all. I loved her." Now, this is the kind of love the world hasn't got anymore. But this is the kind of love we have to have in politics. We have to have it everywhere, or our civilization is simply going to pieces. It is necessary for the integrities in ourselves to save us. We must bring our own wisdom and our own insight to bear upon the problems of daily living. We have long worshipped by attending places of religious gathering. We have been baptized, we have taken communion, we have gone through certain sacraments, particularly in the Protestant communion, the sacrament of marriage. We have done all these things in the name of religion, in the name of a spiritual reality. I know years ago, I performed a great many marriage ceremonies, and several times the young women particularly came to me beforehand and they said, "We need something. We could go to a justice of the peace, or we could go to some orthodox source and have a traditional wedding. But to make a marriage a success, we have to remember something. We have to have felt within ourselves a dedication, a responsibility. We needed the will of God to move us down through the years, or we could not make it. We had to have something beautiful to think about when the going got rough." And so nearly always, those who were really anxious in having a true marriage wanted some type of religious experience in connection with it. They wanted the blessing of heaven upon themselves and their futures. They wanted the blessing of heaven upon their children when they came. And they wanted to grow old and quiet together under a blessed attachment which had been strengthened by a moral dedication. So in these days, we can go back to the Pharaoh Akhenaten, 1,100 years before the beginning of the Christian era, and we can see this frail, sickly man who died of a broken heart. We can see him attempting to convey to Egypt the idea that humanity is a family, that everything about mankind is part of a family pattern in which all the members of the family are mutually desirous of contributing to the happiness of each other. While the pharaohs of Egypt had their stone statues along the banks of the Nile or on the arches of their great gateways, Akhenaten told them that when they pictured him, he was to be pictured with his arm around his wife, and also his children must be playing at his feet. Because, he said, I am a ruler of a people, but my people is a family. And my love for my people is simply the extension of the natural fact that love binds all things together in something stronger than any physical ties that can be made. His love destroyed him. His enemies could not understand it. And yet he remains to this day as probably the first enlightened individual recorded in history. Also, when he was holding audience at court, and the time came for his wife to speak up or to be involved in the discussions, which they usually were in Egypt, he would always refer to her, he would say to the people, this is Nefertiti, my other self. And all through life, this peculiar tenderness marked a truly great person whom the world now begins to recognize. On the other end of the long line is Mohandas Gandhi, who's always been a kind of prophet in our thinking. On one occasion, Gandhi said, this world will never know peace until all peoples are bound together with nothing stronger than the single silken thread of love. Love alone can do it. And today we honor one who we love and we believe we want to serve. But if we really want to serve, we do it not primarily by going to church, or primarily by the daily Bible reading, or by any of these things, or by having sacred pictures on the walls of our houses. The real service, the real message, comes in mutual conduct, one with the other. We have to outgrow something. Between our love principle in our souls and its expression in life is a strange personality equation, full of self-centeredness, full of false ambitions, full of prejudices and tyrannies and intemperances and intolerances. This personality, which we like to cater to forever, is not only a personality that brings tragedy to ourselves, but the compound of this personality has resulted in over 8,000 wars in the course of history. That is rather too many. And many of these wars have been fought to defend peace, but they never succeeded. We have fought also about religion and about the very brotherhood which we need so desperately. And yet, after it's all said and done, and we look around ourselves and we say, well, what can we do about it? It's truly a terrible situation. And if it continues as it is, it'll be a fatal situation. Fatal in the sense, not that the world will be destroyed or that humanity will be destroyed, but that thousands of years of consecrated effort will come to nothing if we do not take on the responsibility of mature relationships with each other. It is no longer possible to think of love merely as a physical attraction. And in spite of the literature to the contrary, in spite of the fact practically all our entertainment is based upon a frothy type of human relationships, none of this is going to do very much to protect us in time of trouble. The thing that protects us is the long-wearing virtue of integrity. Now, in order to love, you have to have the strength to do it. And strength is something that is also being generally sacrificed. We are not being strong these days. We're leaning on every support that society can produce. We can't make our own living, we can't find our own jobs, and we haven't sense enough to save a few dollars when we need them. We have no self-discipline. And therefore, we are dependent upon a continuing expansion of social privileges, and the more we get for nothing, the less we're going to earn. We are not interested in taking hold of our lives, or our nations, or our world, and putting it back on its feet. And no matter how much we pay for legislators to do it, they will not do it unless they have a greater insight than ourselves. And for the most part, this is not true. So, we have to get to work and do some of these things. Sort out the things in yourself that you have mistaken as sources of comfort, pleasure, or security to you. Find out why there is a certain strange fascination in hurting other people. Try to find out why sarcasm is a comforting type of emotion when we should be weeding it out with every moment of our effort. Why should bragging continue? Intolerance, competition, the desperate search of fame, even if it means we have to tear down the reputations of other people. Why do we nurse these things? And if we do nurse them, how can we call ourselves Christians? Christianity is not a conversion to a faith and then keep on living as you did before. And to most people, a conversion by modern methods usually lasts about 1 year. I spent an afternoon with a group of elderly clergymen who had been in the missionary field long ago. And I asked one of them, I said, how do these conversions work out? See, one of them said he'd saved about 500, another one said he'd saved about 5,000. It was quite competitive, by the way, for a Christian gathering. And he said, well, I'll tell you, we used to want to go around the country, you see, and have these tent meetings and baptisms, and they came down the sawdust trail. I said, well, how long did it last? Well, he said, about a year. We got them converted, but if we didn't come back within a year and do it over again, they were bad backsliders after a short time. This is the problem. Under the hysteria of the moment, under a great emotional appeal, under a very brilliant orator, the individual may be moved to some kind of a temporary improvement. But when it comes to crossing his natural interest, making him do things he really doesn't want to do, his religion gradually fades away. We have today alcoholism in the great Christian world, something that should never have existed, narcotics. And we have narcotics very largely being manipulated and exchanged and handled by nominal Christian people. This isn't good. Why do we do these things? Because they're profitable. So little by little, we have crowded our ethics out of our lives. We have taken the attitude that success is the only valuable thing, and to it we must sacrifice all else. Now, there's another side to this coin also. We are sacrificing all that is best in us for a certain amount of temporal gain. We are sacrificing our divine birthright for a bowl of porridge. And when the time comes, what happens? We lie down quietly in the sod or are blown away by the wind, and all this compromise, all this subterfuge, all the happiness that or unhappiness that we think we have caused, all of this fades away. There is nothing left. As it was said of John Taylor, the water poet, in our lives, we write our careers on water. And they vanish. So what is the result of all the compromises? Just that we fold up and depart as we always have. But one difference, when we fold up and depart, we nearly always leave something behind us for someone else to pick up. We leave debris behind us. We leave misery. We leave tragedy. We leave children who were wrongly brought up. business that is not properly or justly maintained. We leave false incentives and false ambitions. And we leave this terrible struggle for profit as uncured within our own selves. So the world gets a little worse after we go because we lived. When in reality, when each of us passes on, the world should have something good to remember us for. So we're going to have to recognize that all the compromising that we do in order to accomplish our own personal desires, all this compromise leads to nothing. It never has succeeded, never can. For all this great struggle of competitive materialism ends at the grave. And we take with us out of this life only what we brought in ourselves. So with this, it shouldn't be so difficult for the individual to say to himself, let's make this daily life a little happier for everyone. Let's try to do it right for a change. Let's take the individuals whom we have ignored for one social reason or another and see if we can't patch up these differences. Let's get rid of 3- and 4-generation family grudges. And most of all, let us make sure we don't start new ones. Let us forgive all that we can of those who have injured us. If Christ says to us, forgive each other, this is the highest doctrine in the world. But it's pretty hard for the average individual to forgive an unpleasant relative or an unwieldy politician. Actually, the first impulse is to revenge. And it is revenge that has ruled the world for thousands of years and caused the wars, crimes, delinquencies, and miseries of the ages. Looking back over history, it is amazing how much beauty has been destroyed by selfishness, how much ambition is torn down, and how little it is gained. The tyrant who gathered a great fortune or became a ruler over men vanished away, for as one philosopher rather wisely observed, no individual has ever been able to kill his own successor. That is something we can't do. We struggle for a while, try to do what we want to do, and then we go. And it would be a very good idea to try to make this going a little bit better for everything involved. How would it do to try for a moment to simply look for the right in the terms of the integrities that we can recognize? We have from the New Testament a great many wonderful thoughts. We have the great belief or realization of the inevitable friendship of mankind. The New Testament emphasizes friendship above brotherhood, strangely enough. Because brothers can have a heck of a time. They can be at each other's throats all their lives and never speak to each other after they're 10 years old. But friends, it's a little different. We may be unhappy if a false friend comes along. But friendship as a whole has more endurance and more possibility of development, and gives us the privilege to pick those that we wish to have close to us, rather than to depend upon alliances of blood alone. So friendship is very important. But in order to have a friend, you have to be a friend. And the having a friend is delightful, being a friend is a nuisance. And this type of thing is part of an immaturity that has been trained into us. A small child, 2 or 3 years old, doesn't seem to have any great difficulty in loving its mother, and she has no difficulty in loving it. She realizes the trust that the child has. She feels the tremendous responsibility of caring for that child. But as she gets older and the child gets older and the things change and break away, most of this noble nearness is lost. And each goes off into a way of their own, in a world in which love is not a dominant factor. Real love, apart from physical relationships, which are very impermanent, real love is rare. And it's not easy for a child to find an example or examples of individuals or societies or nations that really have sincere regards for each other. to find, when you go out into the world, that all the nice things you thought about are false is a great disillusionment. Years ago, when I was young and in my prime, about 12 years old, I went to Sunday school. It was a more or less of a harrowing experience, I'll admit. But it had its advantages. And one of the observations or occurrences was that we followed the journeys of St. Paul with red tacks on a blackboard. And we found all the places where he was shipwrecked or where anything happened to him. And we learned how he was treated here and treated there. And we found out how he preached in Athens in the Acropolis, and also how he was shipwrecked on the island of Malta. All those things were part of a fascinating discussion that was very interesting. So I listened then with more interest to the 1st and 2nd Corinthians and found out some of the things that he had to say about life. How he definitely recommended that everybody forgive their enemies, how love suffereth long and is kind, and how it is most important, and how faith, hope, and love are very vital, and the greatest of them is love. All this was very inspiring, because we were having a little family difficulties at that time, so I thought I'd go home and take the glad tidings that the relatives who had been combating each other for about 100 years would have an opportunity to understand the full implication of St. Paul's message. After I got home, I learned that they had taken on the full implication of my insubordination. And from that time on, we went on speaking terms for a long time. And the golden rule and things of that kind had no effect on the feuding relatives. They didn't care anything about what St. Paul said or what St. John said, and his question if they'd said and believed anything if God had spoken in person, because they had unfinished business. There were still a few unpleasant things they could do while they were still in this world. Now, this is unfortunately too common. It may not be quite as outstanding as some of my examples, but the same principle follows. How many people who say, especially in mysticism and in the higher esoteric phases of religion, can they say that they have no prejudices? How many people can listen to a news report without castigating someone whom they know nothing about? How many people are able to daily live in harmony and in charity and accept the shortcomings of each other with a good grace? How many people, if they receive an unpleasant statement, can accept it without returning it? All these little daily things, the aggravations of life, are completely contrary to what we might call a good Christian existence. Now people will say they can't do it because they can't afford to. They cannot be right because they cannot afford to. But for the most part, the virtues that we need to cultivate for our own security do not in any way interfere with the normal relationships of life. They do not say that we cannot have friends or that we cannot pick them. They do not say that we must become paupers and go out with a begging bowl. What they tell us is that we must live according to the Christian idea. That we must live with love in our hearts, kindness in our manner and demeanor. That we must do things gently and lovingly, and try in every way possible to return good for evil. If we can do this, many of our problems will solve themselves. Otherwise, they won't. And also, in the world, they will not solve themselves unless we solve them. So we have now, on this Easter Sunday, a time of reflection, to settle down and think about things, to decide, if possible, a new birth of the Spirit in us, that the love in our own hearts will also rise from the darkness of doubt and futility, and that we will each of us, in one way or another, and as much as possible, proceed to build a career upon the Sermon on the Mount, that we shall definitely do these things which are now considered to be more or less ridiculous. If a man takes our coat, this Bible says we should give him our cloak also. This is not fashionable anymore as a doctrine. But somewhere behind it is a principle that no matter what other people do to us, we must try, in one way or another, to be as kindly to them as possible. If they come in need, even though we have not spoken to them for 10 years, if we learn they are sick or desolate or deprived, we should go to them, regardless of whether we like them or not, because it is a duty from heaven that we shall help one another. And this helpfulness is not limited to the people we like. It is limited only by our own ability to grow. And I've known several cases where an individual stepping in an emergency in a family which had forgotten him won back the whole family. And they became friendly on a basis of integrity that had never been known before. As long as we have these little problems, let's try to think as St. Francis de Assis thought. He was probably one of the greatest of the Christian mystics. And mysticism is based entirely upon the concept of man's internal experience of the love of God. The individual in whose heart mercy is dominant, who is by nature gentle, by disposition tolerant, and also adds to this a spirit of worship, a desire to truly know his God, try to obey the higher laws of life, and to serve his fellow creature as generously and lovingly as possible. This mystic begins to experience true love within himself. The love that St. Francis found extended far beyond even human relationships. He spoke of his little brothers, the animals and the beasts. He spoke about all the planets and all of the flowers growing in the fields. They were all his children. They were all his relatives. They were all part of his life. And in honor of him, now in many countries, animals are baptized or blessed in the course of Christian worship. And it was a good idea. It would be more blessed if more were blessed. Because actually, most of the things that we do badly, whether we know it or not, are hurting us. When we think we have outgrown something or through a materialistic allegiance have become too sophisticated to pay any attention to simple things, we find ourselves in a very difficult situation. Actually, the blessing of the animals and the birds and the fishes, all of this is good because it helps us to understand the sacredness of life and will help us perhaps not to profane it as we have in the past. In Japan, in the little town of Nara, there is the Sarasawa Pond, a little pond about 300 or 400 feet across. And here, each day, children come with little bowls, glass bowls, with a goldfish in them. And the family is there, the relatives, the grandparents, the aunts, nieces, and relations in general, and very often the temple priest, who is also very much concerned in this important undertaking. And the little toddler, who is 4 or 5 years old, has his little glass bowl in his hands, walks to the edge of the pond and dips the bowl in the water and lets the fish escape. He has therefore liberated a fish. Now, in order to liberate the fish, he had to earn the money to buy the fish. So he worked hard, and after a while, he was able to put together, maybe with friendly family help, the necessary means to buy a little fish about this long. As soon as he had it, a great sorrow came to him. Fish do not want to be in little bowls like that. Fish want to go back to the ocean from which they came, or to the water, or the streams, or the rivers. And so he couldn't be happy with the little fish, because he had made a prisoner of it. So there came the great day of resolution, and he and the family went to the side of the pond and returned the fish to the water. This was the perfect gift. This was the perfect pleasure that he had secured, not in having, but in releasing. Now, this is a practice that has been practiced in those areas for thousands of years, and it involves several other creatures. When General Grant Monument in Tokyo was built a number of years ago and dedicated to General Grant, the dedication consisted of liberating birds. All the birds were set free and to honor this occasion. It was no question at all about serving them up for dinner. It was a question of releasing them back into the world to which they came. When the first American consul general came to Japan, he demanded beef. At that time, the Japanese were vegetarian people. So it was a consternation. And, of course, everyone who had a cow or anything of that kind hid it immediately or sent it up into the mountains where it couldn't be found. But finally, they got a renegade of some kind, backslider from their own beliefs, who sold them a cow. So the cow was properly slaughtered for the consul general, and an international incident was prevented. Some years later, a monument was dedicated on the site where the cow was killed. And the beautiful statue of the cow is on top of it, stating the sorrowful circumstance that it had been martyred for the service of a barbarian. And this was what it meant. Now, these are maybe a little extreme, you know. We don't want to go too far with this. But the principle involved has something about it that is very beautiful. The principle of preserving.